If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
Well, it's a podcast for a Friday. Bob McCown and John Shannon are with you. And
happy Black Friday.
Well, yeah. Well, I'm still in the recovery room from Thanksgiving dinner yesterday.
Oh, and how was it?
It was great. Cooked the turkey and all the side stuff, and it's one of those meals. You start at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and you got to get the turkey ready, and then you put it in, and then you got to get all the sides done. It is like it's 5 hours of preparation.
It's absolute hell.
If you're cooking a turkey, whether it's Christmas or Thanksgiving, it's just a big process. Now, it's worth it in the end. And then you sit down and you gobble all this stuff down, and then you got to clean up. So,
I had turkey last night too. Yes, I did.
Did you cook it?
And I didn't have to. Are you kidding me?
You went and bought us slab of turkey or something.
I supported a local establishment who was offering a U.S. Thanksgiving turkey meal.
Great. I used to do that all the time. We did it right from scratch yesterday. So,
Thanks for the invite.
Well, it's COVID times, John. You got to be careful who you invite. And
I
don't know where you've been. I don't really care.
So, big news this morning.
So, yeah, this morning, for those of you who haven't read the Globe and Mail or seen any of the media as yet, I imagine everybody knows about it, but a story in the Globe this morning that Rogers and the Blue Jays and Brookfield, which is one of the largest, for lack of a better
term,
real estate companies in the world, it's one of the largest companies, period, in the world. Have been in some level of conversation about the possibility of tearing down the Rogers Center and building a new facility. It is an intriguing idea, but it's not a new idea. It's one that actually dates back about a decade, John. I've been trying to put the pieces together in the last hour of the timing of this, but I can't recall exactly how long ago, but I was involved with a small group of people who had a concept that was larger than just a new baseball stadium, but a baseball stadium was to be included in this deal. And one of the key participants in the conversation was Paul Beeston, who at that point was the major domo of the Blue Jays. And to that end, Mr. Beeston will join us probably on Monday. We'll have further information forthcoming to chat about what we looked at back then, the differences in the proposal then from the proposal now, which seems to be to tear down the Rogers Center and construct something new along with a bunch of revenue-generating things like residentials and et cetera. And
it's actually a residential project with maybe a baseball stadium.
Yeah, you're 100% right. And look, to be very blunt, I'm not being critical of that, because that's essentially identical to what we were proposing, although ours was on a, as you will find out, on a much, much larger scale. It was a massive, massive undertaking, and it required political influence, and we obtained that, and it just became so overwhelming. And it involves, remember the Bills in Toronto concept? It involved an NFL team. It involved a new arena for, you remember when Toronto was going to be an expansion team, have a second team. At one point, the guys in Markham were looking at that, but there were all kinds of other people involved. It involved that as well. So we'll share that with our audience over the next few days, how that unfolded.
How realistic do you think this deal could be? Or do you think it's close to being a done deal?
No.
This Valentine's Day, Dunkin's got the perfect pairings to show your love. So get down on one knee with a dozen brownie batter donuts and a cocoa mocha signature latte. Or make them swoon with a strawberry dragon fruit Dunkin' refresher with a Cupid's Choice donut. Are you ready for love? America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.
No, I don't think it's close to being a done deal at all. I think there are, I think it's a valid story that it's being discussed. Do I think it is on the road to completion? Absolutely not. Are there pitfalls in this? A million of them. Not the least of which is Rogers does not own the land under which the dome is being built.
That might be a problem.
Well, it may not be a problem, but it means you're going to have a conversation with the feds, which is what we did.
Right.
We got on a plane and flew to Ottawa and met with the minister.
The one thing different, Bob, about what Sky Dome originally did was, if you look at the city plans in the early 80s and then in 89 when the stadium was finished, it was a major impetus for expansion of the residential side of the western part of downtown Toronto.
Except, it took 25 years for that to materialize.
Everything takes 25 years, Bob. Development takes a long time. It does take a long time. Look at the corridor now between where Scotiabank Arena is and where the stadium is. It became the driver. It was the reason and for all the problems that this stadium has, for all the complaints people have about this stadium. In so many ways, it was the impetus for, the future of downtown Toronto, and it did its job. And
yeah,
that becomes the key question.
But don't underestimate the time lag there. That time lag was significant, a lot longer than everybody thought. And at least in part because, again, the majority of the land on which that development has now taken place is owned by the federal government. So you've got to get their approval for it. And government approvals on any project or property are painfully long. But when you're talking about the feds and the vast amount of land that they actually own,
between them and the railway, Marathon Realty. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
So we'll go through all this stuff over the next few days. The story is just beginning, I guess, from a public sense. Although, as I say, these discussions date back at least a decade and involved a different group of people. But
my point in all this, Bob, is that I know your project was a Downsview. I still am in favor of a downtown stadium, and whatever plan they have, they better keep whatever stadium exists downtown, because I think that's been a really good record of what an inner city stadium can do for an area.
Well,
you don't have to agree.
I'll disagree with you, and we did a lot of homework on this.
Yep.
And the population epicenter of the GTA is it's less than a quarter of a mile from where our proposed stadia were going to be built.
Yeah.
So, and we did a lot of research on that, and then you start talking about access. Well, you've got 401, you've got the Allen if you need it, you've got the 400 is not far away, you've got, it's really the most accessible place.
Well,
for everybody. Now, I mean, you want to be downtown? Okay, fine.
Yeah, I do. I want to be downtown.
Just shut my shit.
I want to take my GO train into the game. I want to go back to my commuter train and go home.
Well, again, at the time that this is all stuff we'll talk about next week, but at the time, remember that they were extending the subway system literally right past there.
Yes. Yeah. The Spadina line.
And it was going further north. And I don't know where it is now. Is it at Steeles? I don't even know. I don't live in that area, so I don't take that subway. Well, I don't live in that area, and I don't take the subway at all. So I don't know, but I know that from a public access point of view, from a public transit point of view, that worked as well. So a lot of work went into that project, and it's still not out of the question. Anyway, I spoke to Beeston this morning. Paul will come on and talk about the things that we discussed back then, his perspective on it. He had a very unique perspective on building a new stadium, the eventual need for a new facility for the Blue Jays, and what was that facility going to look like? What kind of facility was it? And I don't think people will be shocked. I think you and I have talked about this. I've mentioned it back in the days when, remember those old days we used to do actual real radio?
I don't remember that.
Yeah, you probably.
So, but the other thing is we also have to remember one of the reasons why Sky Dome was built for a practical perspective. And that was because the weather in April and May and September and perhaps October was horrendous on the lake.
Yeah, well,
And it needed a roof. And it needed a roof. So they have to find a way.
Turf
in a stadium to appease, long weather issues in this city, and then the turf issues in the city.
Don't forget, you're talking to the guy who was at every Blue Jay game at Exhibition Stadium from April 7th, 1977 on. So you don't have to tell me about the weather conditions.
How many days did you wear a parka?
Few. Opening day, for sure. I had a full-length fur coat on.
Yeah.
On opening day. Which Phil Roof offered me $50 to rent for the day because he was the bullpen catcher. And remember, the bullpens were not only outdoors, but they were actually on the field of play down the left field and right field lines.
I sat in the roof seats there long enough to know it was a wind tunnel at times. So,
oh, no, look at, I'm not anti-Sky Dome. I like the Sky Dome or Rogers Center now. I got nothing against it. But you have to understand, when you remember when the dome was built, everybody said this is where professional sports is going to go. Everybody is going to want to have one of these. And I can remember going down there with the architect. Well, people from all over the world came to see how this building was constructed. Over whatever it was, 2 years, however long, 2.5 years, where they were building it. They had architects, they had political people, they had sports people come and watch how this was put together. This was like the eighth wonder of the world. And in the end, how many more of these were actually built?
Very few.
Essentially,
and technology changed.
Technology changed.
Anyway, let's talk about it
next
week.
We're going to get into all that, all right? So that's next week. I talked to Beeston. So Beeston will join us. We're hopeful of having others who may or may not be involved in this deal be with us as well. It'll be some hopefully intriguing conversation as we follow up on the publication of the Globe and Mail story. We're going to take the break, but when we come back, a couple of guests will join us to talk about the National Hockey League, who on this day have absolutely no plans to come back. I know they're working on it, but right now, we have no idea. We'll talk about it when the podcast continues after this very brief message.
You take my breath away. Whoa, 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 whoa. Can this be true? It's all I can take.
We are back on the podcast. McCallan here, Shannon over there, as per usual. Can't get rid of him. And we have the perilous prospect of having, well, it's not even a prospect. It's a fact. We have no idea when hockey is going to start again. The NBA is getting ready for training camps. It's going to be a couple of days away. It's a couple of days away. And yet the NHL is still, well, we don't know exactly what they're doing. I guess they're talking. Maybe they're arguing. Maybe they're negotiating.
Well, they're not. One of the big issues, Bob, right now is that as of yesterday, they had not talked to the Players Association for about 6 days.
Well, why is one of the questions.
Well, I think it's a game of chicken.
Well, let's discuss it. We've got two gentlemen with us who most certainly are capable and insightful enough to give us a little bit of insight as to what's going on. Our friend Eric Duhachik is with us now with The Athletic. And John Forslund is with the NHL on NBC. Guys, good to see you. Thanks a lot for stopping in. E, to you first. Are you surprised, chagrined, concerned, frustrated by the fact that here we are on, well, we're approaching the end of November, and we have no idea what's happening or when it's going to happen?
Yes and no. But what I would say is that that the history of Gary Bettman and his negotiations / talks / whatever you want to call the thing that goes on with the Players Association has always proved to me that nothing gets done until there's a firm deadline, and then things move very rapidly. And so what I would suggest is that there is no firm deadline yet. All of the modeling that the league and the Players Association have done for this upcoming season still has a January 1st start. And so within the context of that, they were hoping for a 2-week training camp, about 3 exhibition games, and then they wanted to give those 7 non-play-in teams an extra week, right? So you'd need to get everybody in place, at least in 7 of 31 markets, by December 8th, 9th, 10th. But you don't have to play 3 exhibitions. You can play 1. You don't have to have a 14-day camp. You can have 10, and those teams can have a 4-day camp instead of 7. So the real date, in my mind, is December 15th, 16th, where some players have to be in place. And so, as you point out, you know, we're at Friday, November 27th today, and that still gives them a little bit of leeway. And, you know, the owners, because of the economic pressures on them, some of them anyway, are having liquidity issues. They would like to see more deferrals than what was previously agreed to. The Players Association are saying a deal is a deal, and they want to stick to their guns. And so they're in this stalemate. And, you know, circling back to my original answer, in the past, this has been the pattern, you know, that it's stalemated, it's stalemated, it's stuck, it's whatever you want to say. And then in a week's time or 2 weeks' time, when it starts to get really serious, and if you really want to maintain that January 1st start date, which they do, because, you know, everything is dependent on scheduling, et cetera, then I think they'll get serious. So if we were having this discussion 2 weeks from now, I would be frustrated, ready to throw things at the wall. But today I'm not, because it, to me, it just follows a familiar pattern.
John, you share that assessment?
I do. I think when we were in the bubble in Edmonton, some of the speculation, one of the dates we heard was January 18. I don't know why, but some of the, you know, high level people, league people we talked to, Bob, were throwing that date around. I know January 1's the aspiration, right? That's the utopic one everybody tries to get to. But I think what you have to look at here is past history of what could be worst case. Of course, absolute worst case is no season. I would hope no one has appetite for that. I think that's a dead end street, in my opinion. I understand where some of the owners are with that, but you look at relevance for the league and all of that, those things. But if you look at the lockouts and you look at a 48 game matrix, they have it as your bare minimum for some type of a legitimate season. And I would think that's really doable in the middle of January, certainly the beginning of February, if it goes that late. And if you appease some of the owners by saying you push back a little bit more to get to a point where there's realistic hope for people in some markets. Maybe that helps. Maybe Super Bowl Sunday is a date they could look at with, I know in the States that would be perfect for the rights holder here to kind of kick off the season with a 12:30 game, Super Bowl Sunday. They normally have a Sunday afternoon game on NBC at that time. Mm-hmm. And you would finish then, but if you start beginning of February, easily by the middle of July, right? Because we started the end of January with the 48 games. We finished almost under normal conditions with that setup. So I have no idea. I'm just thrown off the wall here, but I think based on the history of the league and everything, they have a cushion of knowing 48 is doable. I think they'd like to do more if they could, but if, as John pointed out, if this is a game of chicken, which it is, similar to baseball, where they pushed and shoved back and forth, until they got to a point where they force-fed a 60-game schedule down the players' throats. I mean, I think we're kind of going down that road, unfortunately.
So, John, you're the token American on the show.
Thank God.
Steady.
How? Well, yeah, you're a landed immigrant.
Thank you.
How important is it for the NHL to optically be playing when you consider the other winter sport, the NBA, is going to be up and running? How much value do you put in that? Particularly for non-traditional markets.
Tremendous value, because it's too easy, John, to put it away in some of those markets, particularly in the market where I live now and have for two decades plus in Raleigh. It's too easy to put it away. In Florida, it's too easy to put it away. I would think in Nashville, it's easy. Dallas and so on, especially if you're up against NBA competition, major college basketball. The NCAA is a wing and a prayer. They're just trying to somehow do this. I don't know if they're going to be successful or not. But it's unfortunate, because remember all the positive vibe we all had in the summer when it looked like, oh my goodness, look at this. Cooler heads finally came together. You've got an extension on a deal that was kind of up for grabs the previous summer, where we're going into September. We didn't know what was going to happen then under normal conditions. Now they've carved out what looks like some labor peace. The players have never been in favor of escrow. They haven't liked it from the beginning of this setup, but they've swallowed it. And now the rules are changing, and we know why they're changing, and we could argue what's fair and what's not. But I think, to your point, relevance for the National Hockey League is very important. If you go away, this is much more dangerous, I think, with the public, based on what everyone's gone through with this pandemic, much more dangerous than a labor dispute. This is almost like, really, you guys can't figure this out to bring it back? You know, it's easy for us. We don't have any money in the game, right? So we're not owners. But
right.
I think relevance, even if you're an owner, you have to look at how successful the league was before this and where it can go next. And if you take a huge pause for this reason, what damage will you do?
All that's true. And yet at the same time, it's curious to me, Eric, to you, that the NBA gets their deal done and the NHL is still waffling.
But there's a simple reason for that, Bob.
Yes,
there's
a simple reason. It's a geographic reason. You got seven franchises in Canada
that can't cross
the border.
It's the amount of league revenue that is coming in without being reliant on people. And the NBA has a much better.
It's a much better situation. I get it, John.
Sure.
I get it.
It's a better business plan.
Yeah,
I get it. And that's not being negative to the NHL owners. It's just a fact of life that hockey, and heck, I mean, we've all lived in markets where we've seen a few empty buildings. They're more reliant on gate receipts and everything in the local market. That's the biggest difference.
Well, let's get back to this this Canadian division thing. I guess we have to assume that that's fait accompli, that this is not a problem. There is no choice other than to have a Canadian division and not have teams traveling across the border. Eric, is that what you hear and understand?
Yeah, and that I've heard and understood that for a long time, way back in August. In fact, I wrote about it a number of times. And that, to me, logistically, that's not a problem at all. In fact, I think it makes a lot of sense. In fact, the response I've had to the columns about the Canadian division are, A, we want to see it, this is from fans, and B, we want to see it permanently if we can. And, you know, there's...
Well, that's not going to happen.
No, I know that's not going to happen. I understand the television issues involved in having a division that includes three different times. But the reality is, you know, this is all about achieving compromises, and this is one compromise where I don't see an issue at all. I do think that the original talk was about bubbles. That was immediately rejected. Then there were, the next talk was hub cities. They don't love hub cities either. So the way things are going to go is that teams, according to the plans that are in place right now, will travel to these, you know, Calgary will travel to Toronto and play twice, and then go to Ottawa and play twice in Montreal and come home, and then have teams come through. So that won't be a problem, and that won't be an issue. To me, the biggest single stumbling block right now is that there are some owners, because of their financial situation, that would rather not play because it's cheaper not to play than to play and lose more money. And that
exactly.
And that's a, but that luckily, as I understand it, from my reporting, is a minority right now. And the majority understand, as John Forsman pointed out, the value of playing. And one of the things we haven't talked about, and this, you know, John Shannon is right up your alley, is that if you play this year, you burn off the final year of your US television deal. And that's critical, because if you don't play and the deal gets told, then you're not at the negotiating table and trying to sign a lucrative extension. And they believe that an important revenue stream will be increased when they have that American television deal. And you can't start negotiating a new one until you complete the old one. So I think that will be the single primary driving factor in getting a deal done. The fact that the league understands they have to play. They have to play, and then the TV deal is up, and then you're back at the table negotiating, hopefully with multiple partners, increase in revenue fees, and at a time when you really need more revenue streams, you'll get it that way.
Well, I actually think that the league is talking to the partners and other rights holders right now for the United States, but only on the basis that the contract expires at the end of the season. And that becomes, and what we're talking about there money-wise is, if you think that we're going to, if hockey was forced to extend it 1 year, that's a $200 million deal. The theory is next year could be between $600 and $800 million. That means they'd be losing and leaving $400 to $500 million television alone in the United States on the table. The other thing about it is, and not many people talk about this, is you'd also told a Canadian package on right. Rogers, and the last year of the Rogers deal is quite low as a number. It's not even, I don't believe it's even $300 million in the last year of the Rogers deal, the way it works on average. And you'd be leaving, in theory, money on the table 6 years from now too. And I don't think they want to do that.
Hey Houston, Conn's prices are invincible. That means prices have been cut low, as in amazingly low, as in won't be beat. In fact, we're backing it up with our low price guarantee. Invincible prices on appliances, furniture, electronics, mattresses, and more. Not invincible enough for you? How about free next day delivery on appliances, TVs, and mattresses? And payment options for everyone, whether you have good credit or building it. Visit Conn's today and find out what invincible feels like.
Well, I get all that. At the end of the day, they're still, you know, waffling back and forth about this. They've had, you know, we've lived through this for what, 9 months? Yes, you had to get the last season completed, and they did that. But then they had that whole time, that 2 months, essentially, to start planning for the future. And did we know whether the pandemic was going to continue? I suppose theoretically not, but we're 99% sure that this was not going to be resolved imminently, that there was not going to be a vaccine coming down the road that would cure all these problems. And yet here we are, you know, counting, as Eric was doing earlier, counting days till they announce something.
But I think, Bob, I think it's, I mean, I don't think it's for the lack of trying and the lack of planning. What I think it is the lack of agreement more than anything else. I mean, it's when you have three groups, in theory, you have three groups. You have the players on one side and you have the owners. Then the league office sitting in the middle trying to find a way to appease both sides. It's quite difficult.
The NBA did it.
What they did in the spring
seamlessly. But again,
it goes back to the power of the rights holders. It's the power of Adam Silver to be able to say, guys, we get $1.8 billion from television. Well, $1.8 billion. You know, look at LeBron, come on up to the table. You know,
Eugene Melnick was on with us last week or the week before, recently, in any event, the owner of the Ottawa Senators, who is not shy of opinion. I didn't really get a sense as to whether he really wants there to be a season or not. I think he's trying to play along with what Bettman wants him to say. John, have you talked to any other owners? Do you have any sense as to where they stand individually? What about your guys down in Carolina?
Oh, well, I don't know. I think I'd be bang on with this. I would think he doesn't want to play. If there's a minority group, and I've heard, you know, speculation of five or six owners that don't want to have a season, I would strongly suggest, based on, you know, his Tom Dundon's business portfolio and the fact that he kind of had to do some reshuffling with Top Golf to put that in a better spot and the other things, I have no idea what else he has, but I can guarantee you that I would think he'd be a guy that wouldn't want to do it. Carolina is desperately in need of gate receipts and people in the building to make it successful. It's a market that is stretched out corporate-wise. It's not obviously it's a small U.S. market, but it's not a market that has a lot of opportunity for the team to tap into different revenue streams from a sponsorship advertising standpoint, the television numbers and so on, all these different things. So, and again, it's hidden in a market where there's rich college football and basketball.
Right.
And other things that people will do. They'll go to the mountains, they'll go to the beach, the weather warrants it. You have other ways to occupy your time. And then, you know, you've got the I'll tell you what, we have a very tight state politically in terms of the crackdowns. So the governor hasn't moved much off of what he's allowing. As a matter of fact, this past week he doubled down again. So I would think that when the time comes to a percent capacity and people allowed in the PNC arena, that's going to be a stretch. So I would think that they're probably in that position, but he's going to have to look at, like I said, at the top, he's going to have to look at the bigger picture. Most of these guys are going to have to, I think, when they get to that point where it's D-Day and they have to make a decision. And unfortunately, I don't think they're there yet. If they're still, you know, we're going to go away for a few days and be quiet on this and be, you know, the players have kind of stated their position and the owners have too, and now we're in a stalemate, then we're nowhere near deadline, right? It's not there yet. Unless you want to play January 1. January 1, I would think the deadline is next week, right? And a lot of these players are in town. A lot of the players are working out amongst each other. So, and that includes Europeans, and it is the case with the Hurricanes. Many of their Euros are back in Raleigh, so they're positioned to get going. It's just, you know, when's that time come?
John. Well, there still are some European players across the Atlantic, and they would require 14 days to quarantine.
Correct.
So that's again another part of that timetable, and we've all talked. We think it's a given that we're not going back into any sort of bubble. John, you were in the bubble. How difficult was it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, listen, it depends on what your definition of difficult is. We're all happy to be working. We were all there. Personally, I felt challenged by it. Professionally, I thought it was a great experience. I'm going to look back at that as one of the highlights of my career. But when you get into the mundane Groundhog Day, every day is the same, total restriction aspect of this, and players being separated from their families and not being able to really celebrate their their wins and get into a position where they have the sympathy of their family when they lose. You know, I think they missed all of that. So I can tell you guys, bar none, there's no appetite to go back to a bubble unless they absolutely see a financial reason why they have to do it. The players and the coaches of the teams all shared the same sentiment. We did this. It's there. Once they got to a point, the Final Four, realizing they could win the cup, the attitude changed a little bit. There was some dog day periods where everybody was, I think there were some teams that wanted to go home if they were honest. But for us, I was there 70 days between the two bubbles, 70 straight days, tested every day, did the same thing day in and day out, room to the restaurant, back to the room, over to the rink, so on and so forth. I mean, yeah, if you want to get negative, it was a little bit much, but you tried to stay up and realize what you had a job to do. And it was pretty cool in some ways, but I don't think that was shared among all the players, and especially the guys who were healthy extras who, right, you know, were there the entire time and never got a chance to play. That was a total, another level of commitment. That was amazing.
One of the other things that Melnick talked about, you know, Eugene, whatever his expertise is, he certainly has a level of that in terms of the pharmaceutical business, because, you know, with BioVel. And he was very clear about the prospect of a vaccine and the problematic issues that are going to face all of us, the government specifically, in disseminating that vaccine, who gets it, when they get it. He said it's going to be really, really problematic. And he also had concerns about the expediency with which this vaccine was allegedly developed. And I got the sense that even though he doesn't say, I don't want to play, which I believe he doesn't, I agree with you, John, that there's a number of owners, and I would think Melnick is among them, that would say,
I think there's 8 to 10, by the way. In my opinion, I think there's 8 to 10 guys.
Could very well be. But
that are looking at their bottom line. They're talking to their own bankers, and they're saying, it's as Eric talked about, it's better for me. I'm losing less money now than I am if I play without people in my building.
Well, I mean, I guess one of the questions I should raise, I'll throw it to you, Eric, by percentage, if there's 10, is that enough to void the concept of starting a season? Like, how many of these guys can stand up and say, no, I won't play?
I don't think 10 is enough. No, I don't. Well, first of all, my answer to you, first of all, Bob, would be that I think that every NHL owner understands that the most important thing is the long game. So you were referencing vaccines in your question. I think that they realize there's a very good chance that even with a vaccine rolling out possibly in January, possibly in February, that it isn't going to have enough of an impact on the ticket buying public to create the level of confidence that you need to go back into a building at even 50% capacity or 40% capacity. My understanding from talking to people, sort of decision makers, is that they feel that the first step is 20% of the people in the building. So similar to what you're seeing in a handful of NFL stadiums right now. And they believe that they will have to get through this shortened season, assuming they play, with very, very little gate receipts. They feel that if the climate has shifted by the time they get to the playoffs, that those capacities may increase to 50%. But ideally, the most important thing, that the thing that they don't want to take their eye off the ball is the start of the 21-22 season. So they want training camps to open on September the 16th, the way they normally do. They want the regular season to open on October the 6th, the way they do. They want Seattle to come in and play and have an expansion draft and pay the final installment of that fee. And they don't want anything to disrupt the fact that this 32nd, very lucrative and potentially very successful franchise comes in. So a lot of what they're doing right now is just to get to that point. So, you know, we're in November, that's September, and in 10 months, ideally, they want to get a season played, television contract burned off, everyone is going to assume losses. The players will be making less money. Owners, no matter how well-heeled they are, will all be operating in the red, some more deeply than others. And I think that that is Bettman's selling point, that this too will pass, but it won't pass very quickly. And if we do anything to undermine the progress of these things by not playing, we could create such a negative situation that it's not worth it. So let's find a way of playing, and let's try to maximize our financial side of things in these negotiations. And again, I'll go back to what I said at the start. I do think that they will eventually achieve a deal as it gets closer to what we used to call in CBA negotiations a drop dead date.
And let's face it, Eric, you talked about the expansion fee. The last portion of that Seattle expansion fee might end up being the largest check all of these owners get. They've received some of it. And the other thing is to consider is, I've been told, a few of them have already spent it. So there are a few people that have been working on their working within their lines of credit already. So they need to find a way on your timetable, expansion draft, regular draft, all this stuff in the summertime, in order to try to accomplish to get back to October, because they want to make sure Seattle gets delivered properly, because they owe, at some point, they're going to owe Seattle something, as opposed to Seattle owing them money.
And look, I understand that, I understand fully what John said earlier, and I understand, I get the economics and the pressures of the economics, and the fact that they don't want to extend broadcast deals for another year. Yes, they would like to open the doors and have a full negotiation with a variety of broadcasters, presumably, this off season. But at the end of the day, it's going to cost a whole bunch of guys a whole whack of dough in order to get to that point.
And maybe this isn't an important point, but I think it is for the teams, development of players. Think about the teams that haven't played since March. All right. Think about, just to pick one guy out, Jack Hughes hasn't played a competitive game since March. And now if you go this long, what happens to he and others in terms of their athletic development, and then also those franchises who are just dormant? If they don't come back and crank up some activity in their markets, what happens when there is consumer confidence? How long do you want to go with this? It's complex, isn't it?
Well, sorry, can I just follow that up? So what, another thing that hasn't come up very often, but is a real concern of some senior management people in the NHL, is that for the most part, the world feels poor. And so, the idea that in the past, maybe you were a part season ticket holder in Calgary, where the economy isn't good, and perhaps your spending patterns will change, your viewing habits will have changed. And so even if you were a longtime season holder in a traditional market, you might decide, I don't want to commit the dollars it takes to get myself in that door to watch those games live anymore. And the longer it goes without fans in the building, the greater the danger is there. And so I think that they need to keep the product front and center, and they need to then eventually re-engage these fans, because they just feel that that a whole lot of people have lost a lot of money in this pandemic, and they are not on the same financial footing that they were before. And one of the things that disappears right away is that discretionary spending associated with professional ice hockey. And so
and that's not just not season tickets, that's also that the ripple effect of that is in sponsorship at both the national and local level. I mean, that we're talking a big pot of money beyond what we're talking about with television. We could be talking about 70% in the end, 70% of revenues that go to the teams has disappeared, and we don't know when it's coming back.
Well, and it occurs to me, and I've thought this for some time, I don't know if I've mentioned it, but if I'm a sponsor, I don't know about you guys what you think, but if I'm a sponsor in the National Hockey League, I'm in no rush. Most advertisers have either canceled or geared back their advertising dollars significantly during this this pandemic. And if I've got an investment and I'm going to arbitrarily say $10 million in sponsorship of the National Hockey League, would I rather hold that $10 million in advertising promotion sponsorship back to 2021-22 or have it implemented right now? Forslund, you're shaking your head. What do you think?
I'm along with the right now. I don't see the I think it's a black hole the other way. And again, I think there's other ways companies can market. And if they they step aside from the NHL, I hate, you know, because we've lived our lives, many of us, you know, with this league and off this league, whatever you want to phrase it. But we love the National Hockey League. We love the game. But to be fair, where are you on the rung of popularity with all the other sports? And if it goes dark, what happens to all of that? Very difficult. Very obviously, it's being wrestled with at the highest level. But I think I don't see an end game to saying, hey, listen, it's better for us if we don't play. Is it really? Is the other side really better with all the things we just talked about? Is that what we're driving at here? I don't know.
It was not our intent to solve the problems of hockey in the National Hockey League with this conversation. And to that end, we have achieved our objective because we have solved nothing, absolutely nothing.
We could actually, the four of us could actually solve the issues for everybody, but they're not going to ask us.
Well, but they, you know, not without getting paid.
It's always been the case.
guys, great to see you.
Same here.
Forslund, I hate you. You're playing golf tomorrow. And
it's okay. I like being hated.
It's okay for you. But yeah, the rest of us are kind of going, what? Great to see you, though. Stay safe and stay well. And hopefully we'll have a chance to chat soon. And Dehachik, you look beautiful. And we'll call on you again soon, too. Thanks a lot, guys, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Is the podcast for today. The weekend is ahead. Enjoy it as best you can. And a little more on the Blue Jays and a new stadium when we reconvene on Monday. Goodbye from Toronto.
This Valentine's Day, Dunkin's got the perfect pairings to show your love. So get down on one knee with a dozen brownie batter donuts and a cocoa mocha signature latte. Or make them swoon with a strawberry dragon fruit Dunkin' refresher with a Cupid's Choice donut. Are you ready for love? America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.